Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. When it comes to the economy, there seems to be more questions than answers. Those questions include how to get the recovery to pick up speed, why so many Americans are not so optimistic when it comes to our collective financial futures, and why the stock market is setting records at a time when job creation continues to lag. Lots of questions, and we've got some terrific people here to help us answer them. With us today is Brad DeLong. He is chair of the political economy major at the University of California at Berkeley. He served as deputy assistant secretary of the Treasury in the Clinton administration under Lawrence Summers. Brad, nice to have you, and welcome back to Kansas City.
Thank you very much.
Stephanie Kelton is chair of the UMKC Department of Economics. Her blog is New Economic Perspectives. Stephanie, welcome back to you.
Thank you, Steve.
Stan Collender is the Corvus Communications National Director of Financial Communications. His blog is capitalgainsandgames.com. These are just a few of the folks in town for the Kauffman Foundation's annual Kauffman Economics Bloggers Forum. And Stan, nice to have you too.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, we're talking about the economy today, which means we're talking about money. Stephanie, you wrote a blog post not too long ago that was titled, "What is it about money that scares the bejesus out of people?" What do you mean that money scares people? Because it doesn't scare me so much as I just want more of it, you know?
Well, yeah, that's probably universally true. Everybody would certainly like to have some more money. What I was getting at in that post was the reaction that a lot of folks have had to what the Federal Reserve has been doing to try to stimulate economic activity and
keeping interest rates low and all that.
Interest rates low and this quantitative easing that you hear a lot about. And a lot of people will use quantitative easing and they'll just simplify and call it printing money. And as soon as you do that, well, then images of Weimar Germany come up and Zimbabwe, and all of a sudden you're off and running to, you know, hysteria land. And so that's what that blog post was designed to get at. You know, what is it about the idea of creating money the way that we do in the modern era, which is really, you know, what the Fed's been doing is creating lots and lots of money with a keyboard, just simply out of thin air. And people understand that, and it freaks them out that the Fed has the capacity to simply create money.
They're printing money, you're saying.
Well, they're essentially, I don't really use the term myself. I think it's an old gold standard term that doesn't really have much significance in the modern era. But the way that fiat money is created is simply in an out of thin air way. And if you ask Ben Bernanke, as Scott Pelley did on 60 Minutes, you know, where's the Fed getting all this money it's creating? And Bernanke very honestly said, well, the Fed has a computer keyboard. And when we want to create money, we just use the keyboard to mark up the size of someone's account. Mm-hmm. And that freaks people out a little bit.
Well, Brad, you're a scholar in residence at the Federal Reserve. What is quantitative easing? Because you do hear that phrase a lot, and I think it confuses a lot of people.
Quantitative easing is when the Federal Reserve buys a lot of bonds mm-hmm. and gives the investment companies and the banks that sell the bonds to it deposits at the Federal Reserve in its place.
And why do they want
to
do that?
People sell their bonds to the Fed. And the Fed then says, okay, we're going to credit your account with your deposit account with extra stuff. And the reason the Fed does that is that right now there are an awful lot of businesses and banks and investment companies that wish that they had safer portfolios. That is, in 2008, 2009, something like $8 trillion worth of mortgage-backed and other securities and other bonds
went out the window.
That people thought were safe investments suddenly became really risky. Ever since then, people have been scrambling to sell their bonds, their risky bonds, in order to get safe assets in their portfolio so they can sleep at night. And the Federal Reserve is simply trying to meet some of this market demand by quantitative easing.
Is this the right thing to be doing, Brad?
I think it's the right thing to be doing.
Why is there so much criticism of the Fed then?
I don't know. Right? We have a hard time figuring out why, indeed, there is so much criticism. Right, that $8 trillion of safe assets disappear from the world economy as people say, uh-oh, the investment banks that produced these securitized derivatives didn't really understand their properties. Mm-hmm. As a result, you have a massive scramble in which everyone feels as if their portfolio is too risky. And so everybody tries to cut their spending below their income so that they can build up their cash reserves. But everybody can't cut spending below income because my income is your spending. And the Federal Reserve is simply trying to fix this and get people happy enough that they're willing to push their spending back up to their income level.
So are taxpayers, are we essentially borrowing money to make these people feel safer and putting, you know, rank and file Americans more on the hook for our national debt, or is that not the case?
Well, the interest rate on the national debt is so very, very low right now that there's a question whether anybody is ultimately on the hook for it.
Mm-hmm.
That right now people are willing to pay the United States government to hold their money. The interest rate on the national debt is less than the inflation rate, which means that if you say the U.S. government sells a 20-year bond to somebody today, when that 20-year bond comes due, the amount of wheat or the amount of automobiles or the amount of computers that the government will have to get in order to pay back that debt is less than how much that money's worth now in terms of real commodities. And when people are paying the government to watch their money for them, it's not the case. The debt is a burden. Instead, the debt is a source of net resources for the government.
Are you buying all this, Stan? Does that make sense to you?
Well, it makes sense, but I think it's over-explaining your question. First of all, I agree with Brad that quantitative easing is absolutely critical right now. Fiscal policy, the other alternative to stimulating the economy, is not available given the political situation.
So we need to do quantitative easing just to help people feel safe again and make them feel more comfortable ultimately to begin investing again.
Well, it's not just making people feel more comfortable. The psychological aspects of that are certain, but it's also to actually stimulate the economy, to actually really stimulate the economy. Mm-hmm. Again, fiscal policy is not available. So keeping interest rates this low, as opposed to having them go to the level they might otherwise go to, becomes fairly critical. But can we go back to a question that you asked Brad a few minutes ago,
yeah,
which is—
because he misanswered it. He didn't answer it correctly, and you got to straighten it out here,
right? Well, no, he went on on
its own lane. I gave the academic answer.
Right. Well, you asked, why are people so nervous about the Fed doing this, or so angry, or so upset? Let's call a political spade a spade here.
Mm-hmm.
There are some folks in Washington who don't want the economy getting better, because if it does, then those in power will continue in power, let me be as direct as I possibly can. I can't tell you the number of Republicans I've spoken to on Capitol Hill. I live in the Washington area.
Mm-hmm.
Number of Republicans I've spoken to who said, you know what, if the unemployment improves, if the economy gets better, if people are investing more and the stock market's going up, then we may not retain control of the House, and we definitely won't be able to take over the Senate again. So there's some of that. Now, there's also a second piece.
I mean, that's going to shock people that there are some politicians out east who would say that our control of the House is more important than the health of the national economy.
Actually, you're telling me that they might be shocked is shocking to me.
Really?
Right, because it's
this is the heartland out here.
Well,
we don't live in D.C. This isn't the D.C. culture.
This is also a place where the governor of Texas threatened to lynch the chairman of the Federal Reserve,
mm-hmm,
a South Carolina Republican, said South Carolina Republican show up in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's the other piece, which is there's a lot of distrust of the Fed because it's independent. You don't elect it. We don't know who these people are.
Right.
And to a certain extent, the Fed is its own worst enemy here because they don't communicate really well, until recently haven't been communicating well with anyone outside of Wall Street. Over the last several years, you guys I'm sure have seen this, Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the Fed, has gone to extra lengths to do a financial seminar for soldiers in Fort Hood in Texas and get around the country, do press conferences, talk over members of Congress who may be trying to sabotage some of the things he otherwise wants to do.
This is a good thing?
That he's out and communicating?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The more people understand what monetary policy is and does and how it can benefit them, the better off they will be, and the better off the Fed will be in being able to do what it needs to do.
Stephanie Kelton, on this whole question of is the Fed doing the right thing or not, where do you come down on it?
Well, I think my position is a little bit different from both of these guys, in fact.
I was counting on that.
Well, you know, I don't have the same kind of faith in the power of the Federal Reserve to engineer the kind of economic recovery that I think my friends here might have. You know, at the end of the day, we've got a real world experiment. We've got the case of Japan, and we can look at what the Bank of Japan has been doing for the last 20 years. And for 20 years, the Bank of Japan has been trying to do exactly what the Federal Reserve has been trying to do for the last 3.5 or so years here, to little, if any, effect. Okay, so this idea that quantitative easing, and if you go bigger and bolder and badder and more aggressive, that's all that you need. You know, a little bit of quantitative easing may not get you there, but a whole lot of quantitative easing will. And as Brad pointed out, what quantitative easing is just an asset swap. All the central bank can do is buy financial assets from financial institutions and replace them with what we call bank reserves, just checking accounts at the Fed.
Mm-hmm.
And the notion that that somehow will cause banks to go out and begin lending and cause the businesses and the public, the consumer, to go out and start borrowing more, for me, it just doesn't hold water.
You're saying it's not enough of a stick, not enough of a push here.
Well, in fact, it has something of the opposite effect, because what quantitative easing does is actually take interest-bearing assets off of the balance sheets of the private sector and replace them with what are essentially non-interest-earning bank accounts. And so you're sucking millions and millions of dollars. In fact, in the U.S., we're turning over about $60 billion a year in interest income. The Fed is sucking out of the private sector and turning back over to the Treasury. And so there is a substantial deflationary effect. People worry about QE, quantitative easing, being inflationary. And in fact, it's sucking income out of the private sector. So it doesn't surprise me that it hasn't worked the way that many central bankers and economists hoped it would. In fact, I sort of expected it not to do much.
Let me ask you a question, Stephanie. The Fed pays, what, 0.25% interest on those accounts that if it stopped paying interest, if it said, we'll hold the money, but you're not going to get anything for it, would that encourage financial institutions to take the money out and put it somewhere else, like invest it in the U.S.?
No. Why would they? I mean, that's the question.
Mm-hmm.
Why would – and it isn't even financial institutions that you want investing. It's businesses. But businesses are sitting on $2 trillion in corporate profits, record profits. And we've got all kinds of slack in the economy. Firms aren't operating their factories anywhere near their capacity. So we look at things like capacity utilization rates that tell you how much of the existing plant and equipment is being used. There's all kinds of slack. So until businesses find themselves producing at a high enough level where they actually have to go out and start spending and investing in new plant and equipment, they don't need to borrow and invest. There's plenty of room in the existing capacity.
But if businesses with excess capacity won't invest, and if the Congress won't let the government put more people to work by spending more money, and if the Federal Housing Finance Administration bureaucrats won't let there be any great reorganization that'll get rid of foreclosures and the foreclosed house overhang.
Your question is, what else do we have left?
Then we either have quantitative easing or we have Jack Lew, Treasury Secretary, stands up and says a weak dollar is in America's interest and tries to push down the value of the dollar and get an export boom going.
Hmm.
Is that what should happen now?
Well, what I'm saying is that it is apparently the only politically possible policy tool doesn't mean that it's going to work. You know, the fact that my parents no one's going to buy me a new toy and I don't have the money to buy a new toy, but I can leave a note for Santa Claus. That doesn't mean I'm going to get a new toy in the morning.
Let me get our listeners involved here. We're talking about the economy with three economics bloggers in town for the Kauffman Foundation's annual Kauffman Economics Bloggers Forum. Our phone number here, 816-235-2888. Our email address, updatedate@kcur.org, or you can tweet us at @kcurupdate. Ken from Excelsior Springs. Ken, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
My question is, we are actually issuing debt money, which means if a person borrows money, there's enough money in the system to pay the debt, but there's not enough money essentially to pay the interest. So somebody else has to borrow money in order to keep the system going. What do you guys believe about that?
Is that right, Brad, the way he described it?
Well, we've always had an economy that's run on a lot of debt, right? We've had an economy that's run on a lot of debt since the Revolutionary War or simply before.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, our interest rates are at extraordinarily low levels at the debt that the U.S. government can finance. So much so that, as I say, for practically every single dollar that the U.S. government owes, right now, it's not the fact that that's a burden on us whereby we have to pay interest, but rather the reverse. Once you take account of inflation, our debt is actually a service that people are willing to pay us to provide to hold their money for them. So that until interest rates change, until interest rates, quote, normalize, unquote, the debt is not a burden at all, and it isn't forcing other people to borrow to pay the interest.
Brad,
now, that may change.
Let me ask, if the U.S. government were a business,
mm-hmm.
was a business, and could borrow at these interest rates. Wouldn't it be borrowing more or trying to roll over its short-term debt into long-term debt to lock these things in for as long as possible?
It certainly would, and so would the government of Japan and the government of Britain
and, why is
and
that
the government
happening?
Of Germany as well.
Why is it not happening?
Is that what you're suggesting?
Well, no, well, there are several reasons why it doesn't happen. Number one, any president right now or who proposed that we borrow more rather than less would be tarred and feathered,
mm-hmm.
right? Politically, of course. That's number one. Number two, there are limits on the amount of long-term debt that the markets will allow. I mean, this is the amount they want to buy. So simply rolling over the short-term debt and into longer-term debt, there are limits on what can obviously be done.
Hmm.
But so you've got a political restraint on the amount you could be borrowing, and you've got a market restraint on the way you can borrow it, and that's why it's not happening.
Okay.
Well, actually, as long as you asked, there's one more reason. If we borrowed long-term, the benefits would accrue over the longer term, that is, after the person in the White House gets out of the White House. And that's not true of just this president. That's true of every president.
Let's go to Jack from Kansas City, Kansas. Jack, you're on the program with our economics bloggers. Good morning.
Good morning. My question is, I'm a small investor, and I'm having a terrific six-month period in the stock market at the present time, and I'm just wondering if that isn't an indicator of some positive economic activity at the present time.
Well,
what does it mean? Yeah.
I think it's an indicator that the future now looks brighter than it looked a year ago, definitely. And it's also an indicator that we have an increasing switch of wealth away from labor to capital. That is precisely because such a low share of Americans are employed right now. There's a lot of downward pressure on wages economy-wide, which means that as workers get a smaller share of the value of what's produced, that leaves more for investors like you. So it's both a sign of good things and bad things happening to the economy.
Why is there a belief that the future looks brighter than we have right now?
Because
the
a year ago,
North Korea is pointing missiles at everybody in the world. Why is the stock market so robust right now?
I think the stock market doesn't believe that North Korea is a threat. That they simply think that they're just talking. And they've talked before and haven't done anything. Whether the market's right to believe that, I don't know. The stock market was really panicked about a year ago. And we actually saw people panic in August of 2011. We had a large downward lurch in the stock market and a huge surprising collapse in the level of interest rates.
Mm-hmm.
And I think most of that is simply a recovery from those depressed levels in which the stock market was between 2 and 1 years ago.
I need to ask Stephanie and Brett, this is a personal as well as a professional question. Isn't part of the money going into the stock market a reaction to the low interest rates in the bond market? That is, you can't really get a return on bonds, and so that...
But that's the way it's supposed to work, right? The interesting thing is that right now, say, adjusting for inflation, stocks are earning 6% per year on average, and bonds are paying minus 2% per year on average, which is an 8 percentage point gap between stocks and bonds. And it's true stocks are a lot riskier in the short run and the medium run, but still, that 8% gap is enormous. It's usually much more like 4%, which shows that relative to bonds, stocks are still substantially undervalued.
Well, but Stephanie mentioned something else. Corporate profits are at record levels. They're sitting on hoards of cash. That's got to be part of the equation also, don't you think?
Yeah.
Stocks can do well with very modest top-line growth. You don't need a robust economy in order for the stock market to do all right. But what you're also seeing right now is an awful lot of stock buying being done on margin. And so people are borrowing in order to buy stock. And so there is something very interesting going on there as well. This is not people making lots of money and investing their money in stocks. This is people borrowing money in order to invest.
So big money still very much on the sidelines is what you're saying here.
Absolutely. Absolutely. No question about it. I mean, you know,
because the money's on the sidelines because
capitalism runs on sales. And until the consumer is back and until businesses are convinced that the consumer is really back. And, you know, for the last few years, households, consumers have been attempting to pay down debt. We call it deleveraging, right? We're trying to spend less and save more and pay down debt because we took on so much debt over the course of the last decade.
And that's a good thing, right?
That we're trying to pay down debt?
Yes.
Yes, it's
been
good.
We were out of control for a while there, right?
Absolutely. I mean, consumers lost, you know, $6 to $8 trillion worth of wealth when the housing bubble burst and then the stock market decline and job losses and so forth. And so, yes, consumers were trying to repair their balance sheets. And in repairing their balance sheets, they had to spend less and save more and pay down debt. And that isn't good for business when consumers retrench and begin to save more and spend less. And until the business sector is convinced that the consumer is finished deleveraging and they're back and ready to start spending again, there's no incentive for businesses to aggressively begin hiring and investing in new plant and equipment.
And are there signs that businesses are seeing that the consumer is indeed rebounding and coming back here, or is it still not seeing hope at the end of the tunnel here?
Well, we get these things in fits and starts, and you get a glimmer of hope here, and then you get a bit of a disaster there. You know, at the beginning of February, one of the interesting things, you had these leaked memos from Walmart executives, and they had the worst start to a month in 7 years. And so they began writing emails to one another and saying, basically, what in the world is going on? This is the worst. These are the worst sales figures we've seen, and these are Walmart. These are Walmart executives. And one of them remarked, where did all the customers go? And their conclusion was that in large part, this was due to the increase in the payroll tax, and that consumers were really feeling the pinch of that 2% increase in the payroll tax or decrease in their take-home pay. And these guys were absolutely freaking out at their early sales figures.
Yeah. I mean, the big message is that since late 2009, we've only had 58.5% of American grown-ups with jobs. And that's been stable, and the normal number is normally 63%. Hmm. Now, for those almost 4 years, we have had about 0.75% per year of population growth and maybe 1.75% per year of increases in productivity growth. So what we actually make has been growing by about 2.5% per year. But there has been no closing of the gap at all between the 58.5% of American workers who have jobs and the 63% of adults who have jobs normally, that all the decline in the unemployment rate has come from people dropping out of the labor force, not from a greater proportion of people getting jobs.
That's discouraging.
That's very discouraging.
Okay.
But profits are high because the bad state of the labor market means that wages are low and leaves more of the value of what's produced for the owners.
Yeah. Let's go back to some phone calls here. And Ken from Stillwell on the Kansas side. Ken, good morning.
Good morning. Very interesting conversation.
Good.
I guess I'd start off by simply saying I'm really surprised to hear three economists talk about the solutions to the economy all coming from the U.S. government. The economy has always been based on business, and yet everyone's saying, yes, the U.S. government needs to fix everything and make everything well, and I think that's a flawed assumption from the start. The second thing I would say is that when you talk about calling a spade, as someone said earlier, then let's do that and call quantitative easing what it is. It's inflation. It's creating currency that's not.
Then why aren't prices rising?
Let me finish, please.
Okay.
Prices are rising. I don't know where you spend your money, but what you get for $100 now compared to what you got for $100 10 years ago, that's not what the government inflation statistics are by any means. In real terms, we've lost 20-30% in 10 years. And you can't just keep throwing money. Look at this. The budget office came out and said, we've got however many government agencies throwing money at alternative energy, and they don't even know the other guys that are throwing it. And so it ends up like Solyndra, completely wasted. That's what you get when you depend on the government to do this. Now, the final point I would make is that I heard a guy say, we can't have a situation where people are not spending all the money that they take in. So what you're doing is condemning saving. And throughout history, every long-term solid economy embraces savings. When you say that we have to have an economy where nobody saves, well, I mean, you're doing it with quantitative easing. You're absolutely blasting the people who've saved all their life and have money sitting aside that they've saved.
What economies run on
amounts.
What economies run on isn't savings but investment. When you have an economy in which there's more investment than savings, you need to boost savings in order to avoid getting inflation. When you have an economy in which there's a lot more savings than investment, then you need to figure out how to get people spending rather than saving, because you're going to have unemployment. And then after people start spending, then you'll be able to get businesses to invest again, because they won't have excess capacity anymore.
I want to go to Stephanie Kelton, the chair of the UMKC Department of Economics, about our caller Ken's point about the reliance on the government and not business to get the economy going. You were shaking your head no when Ken was saying that. Go ahead and tell us what you were thinking.
Yeah, well, so, I mean, I agree with Ken. You don't need to rely on the government to step in and do the spending that the economy needs. I mean, the problem we have today is we have 25 million Americans who want to contribute, and they can't find work. And the reason they can't find work is because there isn't enough demand to warrant businesses going out and hiring them. It isn't therefore the case that the government needs to create all of the demand for all the goods and services. One of the things that I've pushed very aggressively for the last 4 years or so, since the start of the economic crisis, was an aggressive full payroll tax holiday, not just for the worker, but for the employer as well. And I've never spoken to a conservative group or I've never spoken to a group of business owners who was not completely supportive of that policy. And so there is an awful lot that you can do to actually just leave more money in the pockets of ordinary Americans that will boost the spending and create the sales and justify the hiring and investment.
And the Obama administration did a little bit of that, but you're saying not enough, not anywhere close to being enough.
It wasn't anywhere near. So what the Obama administration and Congress passed was a 2% reduction in the
temporary reduction, which has just gone back up.
Yeah. But that was for the employee only, not for the employer. And so, you know, we had 2% less taken out of our paychecks for a period of time, but the employer continued to pay that 6.2%. If you'd gone full payroll tax holiday for both the worker and the employer, you're talking about a 6.2% across the board reduction in wage costs. It would have been huge. We'd have been out of this years ago.
And that's the argument that Paul Krugman of the New York Times has been making for years, that the first stimulus wasn't big enough to really do what it needed to do to jumpstart this economy, right?
Yeah, I mean, you can call it a stimulus. I call it removing drag. You know, it's like a runner. If you put a plastic bag over a runner's head, he's not going to run very fast. But if you take the bag off, you're not adding stimulus, you're just removing drag. And so an aggressive tax cut aimed at people who would be most likely to turn around and spend to boost sales would have been a really, really good thing to do.
Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our very stimulating conversation here with our economists about the need to stimulate this economy. We'll get phone calls from Thomas, Andrew, Ken, and David, and we'll answer this question. Did the Obama administration truly rescue our economy back in early 2009 or not? I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed yesterday's broadcast with columnist Ellen Goodman about the talk, no, not that one, the one about dying, you can find it in all of our previous broadcasts at kcur.org. On tomorrow's program, Missouri lawmakers debate possible income tax cuts and Medicaid expansion, plus the latest installment of 90 Mile View. Well, this hour we're debating the economy, all kinds of different issues concerning the U.S. and world economies. We're visiting with Brad DeLong. He's chair of the political economy major at the University of California, Berkeley. Stephanie Kelton, chair of the UMKC Department of Economics. And Stan Kolander, he's a Corvus Communications National Director of Financial Communications. Our number here, 816-235-2888, and our email address, UpToDate at kcur.org. I should point out that many of the bloggers on our show today and who are in town for the Kauffman Foundation's annual Kauffman and Economics Bloggers Forum will be taking part in a forum on Saturday morning at 10 at Unity Temple on the Plaza. It's free and open to the public. Lots of conversation about the economy at 10 o'clock on Saturday morning at Unity Temple on the Plaza here. Well, how much of this people debate back and forth the impact of the Obama administration to rescue, and I put quotes around that word, the economy, when President Obama first came into office in the wake of the housing bubble and the big collapse of the economy back in 2008. How much credit does President Obama and his team deserve for rescuing the economy or not, Brad? What's your sense, Brad DeLong?
Well, the question is, what else would have happened?
And we don't know that, obviously. We never will.
And Alan Blinder at Princeton, together with Mark Zandi of Moody's, ran a scenario in which the government doesn't have a troubled asset relief program and in which Obama doesn't get Congress to pass the Recovery Act.
Stimulus, yeah.
And they crunched through their numbers and they said that the unemployment rate would have peaked at 15% in mid-2010 without those two big policies.
It wound up peaking where?
Wound up peaking at 10% in late 2009.
So 5 percentage points on
so
the jobless
5
rate.
5 percentage points on the jobless rate, and a whole bunch of banks survived that would have failed. Goldman Sachs would have failed. Morgan Stanley would have failed. Citigroup would have failed. Wells Fargo would have failed.
And do you buy that? I mean, does that make sense to you?
Yeah. I mean, Alan is very smart and Mark is very good. And it's certainly the case that business investment spending and consumer spending were collapsing in 2009. And the idea that without government spending, unemployment would have risen. And the collapse of a few more big banks would certainly have caused a bunch more people to pull in their horns and stop spending and putting people to work as well, as seen by the fact that we got here with the collapse of only two big to fail banks, Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers. Those were the only two that collapsed, and yet they sent the unemployment rate up to 10%.
Stan Kohlender, what's your view of all this?
Well, I'm going to add two more things to what Brad said. He was saying that businesses weren't spending, consumers weren't spending. You had state and local governments cutting back pretty severely at that point, still are as a matter of fact, and trade not helping at all. So you had four of the basic five components of GDP, that is gross domestic product, economic growth, all not contributing positively in any way, in fact negatively in most cases. So the only one that was in a position to do something was the federal government. So without that, I think the numbers that Brad just cited are absolutely right. It's hard to imagine what the situation would have been without that. Now, you asked, does he deserve credit? There are some folks – let me go talk – do it inside the Beltway perspective. There are some folks in Washington who will never give this president credit for anything.
That's right.
Just part of the political strategy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I get asked this question, my bottom line is who cares? All right. I don't really care who gets credit or who doesn't. I'm looking at what's actually happening. Also, let's do one other number. Stocks bottomed out. The Dow just bottomed out at about 6,500 couple of months into the Obama administration. It's now more than doubled and it's close to 15,000. It's one of the biggest bull markets in history. It's hard to see that there hasn't been some kind of recovery, and that it's also hard to say at this point how it could have happened without as fast, let's put it that way, without some sort of federal involvement.
Okay. Stephanie?
I think, you know, if you look at where we were before the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, what's known as the Obama stimulus, was passed, we were absolutely hemorrhaging jobs. We were losing close to 800,000 jobs a month. And in terms of the timing with the passage of the ARRA Act and the subsequent, you know, tax cuts, about a third of that $787 billion, we have to remember, was actually tax cuts.
Yeah.
And about a third was aid to state and local governments to help them because they were absolutely hemorrhaging because taxes fell off a cliff for them. And then the rest was, you know, infrastructure and various spending programs, many of which I didn't like one bit. But the facts are the facts. There's a great little chart book that was put out by an economist who's not an academic, but he went through and he looked at a whole host of economic factors. And these are available. Folks can look at them. They're at thestimulusworks.com. And there's this chart book. And if you click through those, I've presented these in front of various groups of conservative and Democrats. It doesn't matter what. Those charts will pop people's eyes and they'll ask me to send them a copy of those charts. Because when you see the evidence, the way it's presented here, it is pretty compelling.
That's interesting. Let's go back to some phone calls here for our economist, Thomas from Overland Park. Thomas, good morning.
Good morning. I'm glad to be on your show. It's a great honor. The question I had about, or a comment about the labor participation rate being historically low is that I don't have the data on this, so this is only anecdotal, not empirical with data, but I would think that the availability of e-commerce and the internet is creating informal channels for people to supply goods and services to each other. So that it seems as though people aren't participating in the economy when they're, in fact, sort of driving things underground to a certain extent, you know, through their own means, not participating in, quote-unquote, the, on the records.
Yeah. Stephanie, help me understand what Thomas is driving at.
Well, he's saying that there's activity taking place out there, that people are actually exchanging goods and services and things, and that we're not capturing all of that in the official numbers. And we don't see that somebody's become employed. We don't see GDP go up because this is being done effectively in an underground sort of way through, I don't know, Craigslist. You know,
and somebody how significant gets on is that underground economy in this country?
Well, we don't know exactly, but there are reasons to believe that it increases in times like this when the economy is very weak and economic opportunities begin to dry up. People do turn to alternative sources of income.
You pay cash for something because you might get a little break on the price, and that obviously isn't reported on income taxes, and that's what we're talking about
here.
Yeah,
or you trade your guitar lesson services for something else that you need or mm-hmm. want. Yeah.
Okay. Let's go to David from Gladstone. David, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Good morning. The question that I have is relates to inflation as may occur in the future. I recall back during the Lyndon Johnson administration that the war in Vietnam was essentially funded on credit, and that the Lyndon Johnson administration did not raise taxes, but instead spent gross amounts of money. And then I recall the near hyperinflation of the late 1970s, and had always heard that there was a relationship between those two, that it had just taken a number of years to work through the economy. And so I guess my question is twofold. First, do you consider that to be valid? And second, if that is valid, what about the potential of the Bush administration's operation of a war in the Middle East and lowering taxes at the same time and the future impact on inflation?
Interesting.
I would say that of the three causes of the inflation of the 1970s, the Arab-Israeli War of 1973 and then the Iranian Revolution of 1979 as one, the Richard Nixon's belief that he'd lost the election in 1960 because money had been too tight under Eisenhower and his Federal Reserve was going to be an inflationist Federal Reserve being the second, and Lyndon Johnson's not wanting to pay for the Vietnam War being third, that Johnson's policy mistake is ranks third in the cause. Nixon's mistake ranks second, although, well, from Nixon's perspective, it wasn't a mistake. He got reelected. And the 1973 and 1979 uproar in the Middle East was the first.
Because of oil prices?
Because of oil prices.
And what about the Bush administration's decision not to raise taxes during war in Iraq?
Well, you know, it's put us in a somewhat worse situation for the long run. But once again, I'd say that if something like the late 70s comes back, its probably source would be disruption to international commodity markets, rather than the United States government's funding decisions.
You know, Stan, what about this question that everyone seems to wonder about, which is the size of the national debt, which stands at $16.8 trillion. For the record, that's $53,416 a person, although I grabbed that number last night and it's probably gone up since, right? Are we walking down the gangplank toward financial ruin or not?
All right, take a deep breath.
Yeah.
Right. First of all, the debt's not that. The publicly held debt isn't as high as you cited. That's the total U.S. debt, which includes debt held by the trust funds and things.
All right.
Without going there, it's not so much the total U.S. debt. It's whether the debt's rising as a percent of GDP and whether it's rising relative to the growth in the economy. Right. The level that a lot of economists like to use is unsustainable at its current levels. But they're using 10-year forecasts that are almost certainly wrong. Right. So there are also a lot of other things that usually the next question I get based on what you just said is, aren't we going down the road at like Greece or Cyprus?
Yeah, right.
The answer is no. All right. There are so many differences between economies that are the size of Rhode Island and the economies that like the U.S. that have their own currency that they're not comparable in any way.
So you say don't worry about it. We're fine.
Well,
take a chill pill.
Yeah, to a certain extent. It certainly at the current moment, concerns about the debt shouldn't be stopping us from getting the economy back up and running.
So if you were president and free of politics, you would do what? Another stimulus package to get us going again, to jumpstart things?
Well, I mean, if I were president, the first thing I'd do is call my mother and let her know, right? Okay.
sure.
Right. And Mom, if you're listening, I just, you know. But,
I made it.
Yeah,
finally.
Actually, I would be more concerned with economic growth right now than I would with the deficit or debt. Absolutely.
Yeah. Stephanie?
100,000,000% in agreement. Yes, of course. If we were in decision-making, if we had decision-making authority, I think we both realize and recognize that we have an economy that is vastly underperforming. And so we have this huge, we call it a GDP gap. It's the difference between what we would be producing in terms of output and national income if we were operating at full employment and what we're actually producing today.
Mm-hmm.
And that gap, that difference amounts, it measures all of the lost income. And right now, because we failed to get this economy to full employment, we are leaving on the table something like $9.5 billion every single day. We can never recover it. We can never go back
because
in time. Because it is the output that we aren't producing because we have unemployed resources, people not making things, not selling things. $9.5 billion a day left on the table is absolutely insane. Forget the national debt clock. There's another clock out there, and it's called the lost output clock.
Yeah.
And it ticks just like the other one does, only it's calculating the trillions of dollars in lost output and income.
Well, Brad DeLong, two of our three economists are saying don't worry about the national debt, and your answer is what?
The big thing to worry about is that, as Stephanie said, we have only 58.5% of adults at work.
That's a bigger concern.
And we can have 63% of adults at work without worrying about inflation. That should be the most huge concern. Maybe the best thing to do to try to fix it would first be to deal with our housing finance problems and with the fact that there are huge numbers of people who are both being foreclosed on and huge numbers of others who are living in their sisters' basements because they can't get credit.
Yeah.
But then there will indeed come a time to worry about the debt, I think, but that time will come only when the bond market tells us to worry about it. And the bond market will tell us to worry about it when the interest rate on government debt gets above 7%. Until then, we really shouldn't worry about it. It's a problem for the future, not a problem for today.
Okay, so we can all relax about the national debt. That's one takeaway from today's show.
At least for a
right?
while.
At least for a while. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Interest rates will tell us.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank all of you for coming in here this morning. Brad DeLong from University of California, Berkeley, Stephanie Kelton from UMKC, and Stan Collender from Corvus mm-hmm. Communications. And thank you all very much for a great conversation. And again, reminder, 10 o'clock Saturday morning at Unity Temple on the Plaza. This conversation will continue with many of the bloggers in town for the Kauffman Foundation's annual Kauffman Economics Bloggers Forum. Thank you all again very much. So good to have you.
Thank you.
You bet.
Thank you very much.